following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
I was late. Sorry. I was in the other room. I was talking to David, and I'm like, I got to go inside. It's got to be getting close to showtime. And walked in here. It's already after 5. So I apologize. I was late. But we're here. I wasn't that late. So here we are. We are streaming. We're on YouTube. We're on, I think we're everywhere. Hi, it's Friday, and that's a good thing. So we have a lot to talk about today. I have a wonderful guest coming up. You know, I was never much of a history buff when I was a kid, but the older I get, the more interested I am in learning about, you know, what came before. And so our guest today is the author of a book that just the pitch sounded fascinating to me. It's called Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. And it's a book written by a guy who's an author, who it tends to be an author about historical events. So he did a whole bunch of stuff on American history, on the Revolution and on the beginnings of this nation. And then he decided to, I'll save it for when he's here, but basically trace George Washington's travels from 1789 to 1791, from, let's see, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, all the way he goes down to Savannah, Georgia. So there's the whole map is right here. Can you see that? Oh, yeah, I forgot. I was late. I didn't even turn on the big, powerful light that I usually have shining in my face, so I don't feel like I'm being interrogated. Anyway, we'll get to that. There is a lot of news happening today, so let me start with the breaking news. All right, so to bring you up to speed on what's going on, let me pull my notes up. I'm so discombobulated from not sitting here as the show is starting. I'm thrown off. I usually have that minute or two before to kind of chill out, and I didn't. I just jumped right in. So here the latest news. First, this just came down literally moments ago. A federal advisory panel with the FDA has voted to recommend administering the Pfizer vaccine booster to people over 65 and to those at high risk of severe COVID-19. I guess that would include me because, yeah, I'm not over 65, but as a lung cancer survivor missing really my left lung, what my oncologist said is that I should get the booster because if I were to get infected with COVID and get pneumonia that goes along with it, it could be really bad. So, but the panel, they debated all day, and about 4 o'clock, they came out with a ruling and said they ruled against adults 16 to 65 getting the booster. So, the panel had earlier voted against a broader proposal from Pfizer to make booster shots available for people 16 and older. So they also say the shots would be given at least 6 months after the original 2 shots. So that's the scoop on the booster. We, the United States, are apparently buying millions and millions of more doses to give to countries around the world that really need them. So, you know, that's a good thing. Other news happening today, and that is, I mentioned this in What's News, so I guess I should go back to the original story before I give you the update on this, and let me scroll through and find it, because this is a weird, weird story. All right. The New York Times reported this morning that French officials were expressing outrage about a pact that President Biden announced yesterday that will help Australia deploy nuclear-powered submarines. Biden said when he announced the agreement with Australia and the UK that it would reinforce U.S. alliances, a goal as the U.S. seeks to counter China's influence in the Pacific. But the foreign minister of France, Jean-Yves Le Drian, I'm sure I butchered his name, said that the pact would prompt Australia to withdraw from a $66 billion deal it struck in 2016 with France to buy submarines from them, calling it a, quote, unilateral, brutal, unpredictable decision, similar to unpredictable and destabilizing policy changes made by the former guy. So the foreign minister of France likened Joe Biden's decision to make this deal with Australia and the UK to actions that the orange former twice impeached orange guy made? I don't think so. Nicole Baccaron, a researcher at Sciences Po in Paris, said that this could mark the start of a, quote, very hard period in the longstanding alliance between Paris and Washington. Oh, that's interesting. So what just happened, the news that just broke, is that France recalled their ambassadors to the United States and Australia over this submarine dispute. The decision to recall the diplomats for consultations underscored French anger over an agreement by the U.S. and Britain to supply Australia with nuclear-powered submarines. The deal scuttled the sale of French submarines to Australia, and French officials said they were not informed about the accord before it appeared in the U.S. and Australia's media. Here's the thing, and I got to thank listener Susan for alerting me to this, but she said she was listening to Ian Masters, whose show airs on the Progressive Voices Network, and I believe KPFK in Los Angeles as well. And he had a person on discussing it, and she said that the French did not even have a prototype for the submarine that they've been under contract with Australia for five years to deliver them. If they didn't have plans for a prototype for this submarine, why should Australia be bound to this deal? So I'm sure there's a lot more in that I don't know about. But what's interesting is, you know, France is a pretty good friend of the U.S. So this is apparently, you know, screwing up that relationship even more than Trump did. And that's saying something. Anyway, yes, Carl Jacobson, every little bit helps. Carl made a donation in the YouTube chat room. They have the super chat thing, so you can donate. We run on your generosity. So every bit helps. That is very correct, Carl, and I thank you very much. All right, well, Michael SW in the Bronx was holding, but I guess he got impatient. Sorry, Michael. The way this show works, just so you know, I don't have a producer. I don't have anyone answering the phones for me. So when you call in, if I see that you're calling, I will bring you up and put you on hold. And, you know, when I can get to you, I'll get to you. But if you don't want to hang out and wait, that's okay, too. So today also marks the 10th anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. 10 years, right? And I went back through my photos. I have pictures. I wasn't there for the beginning of the actual Occupy movement, but there was another movement that launched at the same time. Well, it was October 2011. And in fact, their website was October2011.com. I believe it was the World Can't Wait was the name of the program. And they had been planning to occupy Freedom Plaza in D.C. And it was, you know, it was building up to this October 6th launch. In the meantime, on September 17th, a bunch of activists occupied Zuccotti Square in New York City. And that became Occupy Wall Street, and it quickly spread to D.C. and other cities. And then this other sort of, I guess, companion protest started as it was expected to on October 6th, and I was there for that. So maybe when we get closer to October 6th, I'll share some of those photos. I was just looking through them, and one of the organizers of that event was Kevin Zeese. Wonderful, great lawyer, activist, who was just, you know, as someone that I had on the show dozens of times over the years. And very sad. We lost him. God, it's got to be like 2 years ago now. Just shows how time flies. Not when we're having fun. It's just time flies. time marches on, as they say. All right, I see Michael is calling back. Michael from the Bronx, hey, what's on your mind? Michael, can you hear me? Going once, going twice. Michael's calling, but he's not even listening. All right, sorry, Michael. I don't know what's up. He emailed me. He said he wanted to call in. I said, sure, call. But I guess he didn't hear me. So, well, maybe he'll call back and maybe he'll hear us because I guess he's got a burning comment to make. Other things going on. Obviously, tomorrow is September 18th. And there's a protest planned for D.C. In fact, they have put the fence up around the Capitol again, temporarily, but it is up. It is the the whole thing is just it's hard to even talk about because this is an event to celebrate the January 6th insurgents who are still locked up in jail. Seriously, it's a show of support for the January 6th insurrectionists. Now, you know, nobody really knows what to expect. Apparently, there's a lot of chatter and people are making threats, like ugly, horrible threats. But, you know, all the politicians are staying away. All right. Well, this isn't Michael. It's, I think, someone calling from Seattle. Hi, who's this? Hello? Is there something weird with my phones? Can you hear me? Hello? Okay, there must be something going on with the phones because I have a caller here, but they don't seem to be hearing me. Hello? Okay. Now I heard something. Can you hear me?
You're welcome.
All right, I'm not hearing you. Maybe it's my phone. I don't know. If somebody else wants to call in and see if it works, 954-889-6410 is the number. Because something weird is going on. Anyway, we'll see what happens. and if my phone system starts, luckily our guest today is going to be on Zoom, so it shouldn't be an issue. But, you know, a lot of the politicians are warning people against coming. They're not the usual suspects. The Marjorie Taylor Greens and the, what's his name, Matt Gaetz and those guys are not showing up. And Trump, you know, says he supports the people, but is worried that this is a setup. Oy, just please. Really? The whole thing is ridiculous. So they don't know what to expect. They will have a big, Capitol Police will have a big police presence. They did have the National Guard on standby, but I understand that they've since said, you know what, we're good. We can handle it without the National Guard. So I don't know. I guess we'll see. The organizers are cautioning participants not to wear pro-Trump gear and that they should, I love this part, act peacefully. I don't think they're that good of actors. Got it? Trump, who couldn't stop himself, issued a statement. And the statement says, our hearts and minds are with the people being persecuted so unfairly relating to the January 6th protest concerning the rigged presidential election. Ah, God, fuck you, Trump. Just really. Fuck you very, very much. Yeah, I don't think I'm getting phone trolled. I mean, I'm responding to somebody in the chat room, John in the YouTube chat room. This 206 caller from Seattle, maybe, but I know who called in before. I just think he couldn't hear me. And I don't know if my phone's just not working. I don't know. I guess we'll find out eventually. But I'll tell you what, let me do this. So in knowing that I'm going to talk to this author who went back and really tried to get into the footsteps, follow the footsteps, at least in his travels, of George Washington, I thought it made me think about the presidents in our lifetimes, in my lifetime. So I've been on this planet for 61 years, closing in on 62. Oh, my God. The first presidential election I ever voted in was 1980. I voted for Jimmy Carter for a second term against Ronald Reagan. I actually heard Randy Rhodes yesterday say that her first vote was for Ronald Reagan. Wow. All right. No, I was never went down that road. Voted against Ronald Reagan. As I said yesterday, I have voted against the other guy in every presidential election except for the first of Obama's. And I was, you know, I was taken in. But anyway, I started thinking about how flawed our presidents are, like seriously flawed, right? So through my lifetime, I went back and I looked at all the presidents since I was born. I was born in November of 1959. And when I was born, the president was Dwight Eisenhower. Eisenhower, a Republican. A Republican who I would say is probably was more progressive than most of the presidents, certainly in recent history. The thing that most stands out to me about Dwight Eisenhower is that as he was exiting the office, he warned about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. Such prescient words, and I wish the people who came after him in his party, you know, would have paid attention to those words because, oh my God. All right, so Eisenhower was followed in 1961 by John F. Kennedy. You know, John F. Kennedy is like, has this larger than life persona, reputation. The fact is, he was only in the White House for 2 years. He was elected in 61 and assassinated in 63. So I was 3 years old. Little wonder that I have no memory of it. I do have a memory of 1968 when it was like, it felt like funeral after funeral on the television because of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. But so JFK was elected at 43, the youngest person ever elected to the presidency, although Teddy Roosevelt was younger when he took office because he inherited the office, as it were. He wasn't elected into it the first time. He slid into it. So there's a piece of trivia for you. JFK is also the only president to ever have won the Pulitzer Prize. He won it for Profiles in Courage. He also established He established the Peace Corps, and he averted nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he signed the Equal Act Pay of 1963. And again, he started the ball rolling on a number of things, but then he was killed, and it was left to his vice president, who became president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, to pull them off. Now, let me say this. Johnson was also a flawed human being. Look, as was Kennedy. Kennedy was known to have fucked around. He fucked around on Jackie, right? He was said to have had an affair with Marilyn Monroe and whoever else. Apparently, there was, you know, FBI files on him. So, you know, presidents have been flawed throughout history and throughout our lives. But LBJ was a flawed man of another sort. Now, in that era, he did, you know, what he did. He did the things that he did today would get him thrown out of office. LBJ, we talked about this with John Nichols the other day, how he knew how to play hardball. He knew how to work Congress to get them to do what he needed them to do. He would wheel and deal and threaten and hold things over people's heads and you know, give them, lure them into deals and threaten them if they didn't make the deals that he needed them to make. And because he was so persuasive, he got a lot done. The Great Society, right? The Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the War on Poverty, Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid, all that happened under LBJ. But the other part of it, well, there's two parts. If not for the Vietnam War, I think LBJ would go down as one of the greatest presidents of all time. But there was that little problem with Vietnam, which overshadowed everything else. And he wasn't the one who ended it either because, well, it ended during Nixon's administration, but we'll get there. The other thing about Johnson, and the reason I say he'd probably be drummed out of office if someone were to do what he did today, Lyndon Baines Johnson was known to have had, you know, they talk about walk quietly and carry a big stick. Well, Johnson carried a big dick, and he wasn't quiet about it, and apparently he liked to whip it out and show it to people. He would call people into his office and go into the bathroom, leave the door open while he sat on the toilet and took a shit and was telling them why they had to go along with this deal, you know, the Voting Rights Act, for instance. And apparently he was known to whip out the dick and, you know, show how big it was. Couldn't do that today. So that was Johnson. And after Johnson left, we got Richard Nixon. And we think about Richard Nixon as the, up until Trump, the most corrupt, the worst president ever. And he was pretty awful. But Nixon also did a lot of interesting things. I know he was involved in health insurance and creating HMOs, which is not a good thing, but I think the intent at the beginning was there to get more people access to health insurance. He also put into effect, I believe, the Clean Water Act. I think that the Environmental Protection Agency came into being under Nixon, and he opened relations with China after 21 years. So he did try to do some good things. Thing is, his manic, crazy, paranoid, evil personality, I think, it just took over. And of course, he wound up resigning, being the only president in American history to ever resign. And he only did because he knew he was going to be impeached and he would have been removed. But you think about it, what he was impeached over, I mean, Watergate, that's like small potatoes in today's world of corrupt politicians and dirty tricks and lies and cheating and all that stuff. Although I know that's gone on through history. But Nixon, yep, Clean Water Act under Nixon and good vibes with China. Yeah. So he actually did some good, but it was overshadowed by the bad. Gee, that happens throughout history, right? Nixon's first vice president didn't ascend to the presidency when Nixon resigned because Spiro Agnew had to resign it's a good thing it's Friday because my brain and mouth are not working together. A crisis, a scandal, Bagman, Rachel Maddow, I think, has a book coming out about it. Did a whole podcast about Spiro Agnew, but there's a name that I thought I'd never have to hear again. So there was Agnew. He left. Gerald Ford came in, and Gerald Ford became president when Nixon resigned. And what is Gerald Ford most known for? He pardoned Nixon. There you go. After Ford, America elected a Democrat again, and we got Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, probably the nicest guy to be president during my lifetime, but not the best president. He was amazing, or still is, in his post-presidential life, right? Jimmy Carter has done so much. He is, I think, one of the best people, because we're seeing how they're all flawed. Jimmy Carter, probably the least flawed among them. You know, he made national news when he did an interview with Playboy. This is back in what, the 70s, right? Saying that he had lust in his heart. He put solar panels on the White House roof. Reagan, of course, removed them. He established the Department of Energy's Departments of Energy and Education. But the Iran hostage crisis happened on his watch. In fact, those hostages were taken. The American embassy in Iran was taken by the militants on November 4th, 1979. I remember that day as clear as if it were yesterday, because number one, it was my 20th birthday, and my mother had died 10 days earlier. And I remember thinking, oh my God, my mom's gone, and the world has just changed. And it was a year later, on Election Day, November 4th, 1980, that Ronald Reagan was elected. It was the first presidential election I could vote in. I voted for Jimmy Carter against Ronald Reagan. But Ronald Reagan won the presidency on my 21st birthday. November 4th, 1980, and that's the day that the hostages were freed in Iran. That should have given everyone a giant clue as to Reagan is doing some shady behind the scenes negotiating here. So Ronald Reagan fucked everything up. Everything. He enacted, you know, he brought us trickle-down economics or Reaganomics. In 1981, shortly after he took office, he cut domestic spending and taxes. He slashed them. The top income tax rate was 70% when Reagan came in. He lowered it to 50. That was the low, and lowered the lowest tier from 14% to 11. And then in 1986, he did it again. He cut the highest personal tax rate from 50% down to 38.5. And the following year, it went down to 28%. Ronald Reagan lowered income taxes on the wealthiest Americans from 70% down to 28%. He did a lot of other things, too. I mean, and most notably, probably the Iran-Contra scandal, which was probably going on, and that's how he got the hostages out. Ronald Reagan, that's right. What did I just see? Dan Marceau in the YouTube chat room said he did what Trump did with the Taliban, except Reagan did it with Iran, and sold them arms to give money to the Contras who were fighting against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Like, what the hell? Of course, his vice president was Papa Doc, George H.W. Bush, who came up through, you know, he was a CIA director. He was one of those people. So after Reagan served two terms and those last few years, he was not all there. You know, it's funny. These Republicans should point at Joe Biden, who seems to be a hell of a lot more lucid than Ronald Reagan ever was. But then George H.W. Bush, takes office. He's in from 89 to 93. And he invaded Panama and overthrew Noriega. He launched Operation Desert Storm in January of 1991 to thwart Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait. In fact, I went to Saudi Arabia on the eve of the beginning of Operation Desert Storm to a morning show I produced. We went over there to do a show and come back. That was that was our, like, you know, first entree into war since Vietnam. Oh, and Papa Doc also put Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court, who's in the news again today. Errol Thomas said, Nicole, what about the LAPD's crash unit Reagan supported during the 80s? Obviously, I'm not going through everything. This is a very cursory look at the presidents who've been in the Oval Office during my lifetime. I'm just giving you the brief highlights. We could go for hours and hours and hours. I'm not going to be able to hit on anything. Thankfully, H.W. Papa Doc Bush only lasted for one term, and he was beaten by Bill Clinton. Well, Bill Clinton, what do I need to say about Bill Clinton? Come on. We're watching the American, what is it called? The American Crime Story impeachment on FX that is about the Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky affair, whole story. Bill Clinton, talk about a flawed man who should have known better, who just couldn't keep his dick in his pants. And that's what, you know what, as much his administration, you know, there were some good years there. He balanced the budget. Not that I think that's really important, but he did. And in another time might have gotten some credit, but all Bill Clinton will be remembered for is that he couldn't keep his dick in his pants. And then that gave us George W. Bush, who just might be the dumbest man to ever become president. Now, again, I'm not a historian, so there may have been some who were even more dumb than Dumbia. But I did, when he left office, I put together a montage of Bushisms A to Z. I went through the whole alphabet and did a whole thing. And it goes on for about a half hour. the man was a walking... I don't even know how to describe him. I was glad when he left. He got us into two horrible wars that we never should have been in the first place, one of which we just finally extricated ourselves from 20 years later. Thank you, W. And that led to Barack Obama. And Barack Obama, I know I'm going to piss off people in the chat room, but I'm sorry. He was the most overrated, underperforming president that gave, you know, that ran on hope and change, who gave us none of that, who left the Democratic Party, frankly, in the worst position than any other president I can think of. Again, I'm certainly no historian, but, you know, the Democratic Party, after Barack Obama, had, you know, the worst, he left the party in such bad shape. We had no bench. Congress, we were not in good shape, and state legislatures were all in Republican control. He did not do a good job for the party, and you know, and that's a shame. That's his legacy. He came in with such fanfare and such hope, and he didn't do anything that he should have done, that he could have done. He squandered a great opportunity, and then that led us to Trump. And you know, I don't even have to say anything about Trump. Because you know, we lived through that for the last 4 years, and now Joe Biden. And I got to say, I'm really surprised as I go through this list of people who've been president since I've been alive, and Joe Biden, well, next to JFK, I mean, sorry, next to LBJ, might be the most progressive of them all. And it's the last thing I ever thought of. But it just goes to show you, every single one of those men, and yes, they're all men, are human. We think that the president is going to have these like superpowers and you think of George Washington, the father of our country. And the more I learn about George Washington, the more I think maybe he was not, the other presidents who came after him did not follow in the mold. So I guess this is a good time to bring in our guest. His name is Nathaniel Philbrick. He's an author of a number of books dealing with different aspects of American history. Nathaniel, welcome to the show. It's so nice to meet you. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to meet you.
So the book is called Travels with George, In Search of Washington and His Legacy. That's already up on the screen. I don't need to hold up the book. And I love the concept of it. You decided to take a road trip with your wife and your dog, no better way to travel, and follow Washington's travels. What was the purpose of it? Why did you decide to do this?
Well, you know, the country was as divided as it's ever been in my lifetime. And I decided, well, what if we followed George Washington's travels as president when he realized that this country at the very beginning was already politically divided? The Constitution had divided the country into those who were for it, those who believe in a strong federal government, and those who distrusted the strong federal government, the anti-federalists. Washington knew he had to do something to reach across the aisle, even though the aisle really didn't exist yet. And how to do that? Well, he was the most popular man in the world at this point, having won the American Revolution. He decided to go on a road trip. This was before mass media, before you could turn on a TV and see the president and he could talk to you. He had to go to all these towns,
right,
all 13 states, and he didn't travel by Air Force One. He got on, he was pulled by a carriage and would go to hundreds of towns up to New England, southern tour that took him 3 months, all the way south to Savannah. And so this was the story. I decided my wife and I and our dog Dora should follow George and see at this time of unprecedented political division what Washington did at the very beginning of this country's history to try to pull us together.
And, you know, and that's amazing. When I hear you say, and you write it too, that the country was as divided then as it is now. And that is just, I mean, I believe you, but that's kind of unbelievable because I can't imagine anything more divided than we are today.
Absolutely. And, you know, you think Washington was the great conciliator, and he was in a way. He was able, during the first 2 years of his presidency, it didn't matter if you were Federalist or Anti-Federalist, you only wanted Washington to be the first president. You know, he was the only one with the stature to do that. But once his policies came into view, once he began taxing the American people, once it became clear this was going to be a strong federal government, people began to object to it. And his own Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, began to surreptitiously lead the opposition.
Wow.
And so while Washington is touring the South in the final leg of this journey, Jefferson and James Madison head north to the new state of Vermont on their own tour to begin to organize the political resistance, what will ultimately become the Republican Party, and so of their day.
Right.
And so Washington was able to create a sense of nationhood, but he was unable to contain the demon of partisanship.
And there were no political parties yet. Of course, there's no political parties written into the Constitution. That's not right. Part of what they envisioned. But there was still a political divide. It just wasn't organized yet.
Right. Exactly. It wasn't organized. And that was Jefferson's great contribution to the political system.
Oh.
I mean, you could say he created the two-party system by creating an opposition party, whose position was the Washington regime, thinking that it was too monarchical, they feared it was too much like King George. And, they wanted the states, all states to have the power they once had, all of this. And so, it's eerily reminiscent of where we are today. Those who are for a strong federal government, those who want the states to be where the power resides, this is in the country's DNA. It's part of what we have to deal with. It's messy. It's ugly in many times, but it's how democracy works. And the one thing this book, this experience gave me was a kind of faith. I mean, I finished this book just before the presidential election, where I didn't know where it was going. I had, and the epilogue of the book is, does not end on a high five note by any means. But I have to say, I have faith in this country. Partisanship seems to have its ebbs and flows. And, this is ugly now. Hopefully we're going to get to the other side of this in some way. I don't know any other way to continue, honestly, given, what this country is.
Right. I worry for our future. Look, tomorrow is going to be this January 6th a rally in support of the insurrectionists who are still in jail after invading the Capitol on January 6th. I talk about opposite world all the time, where things just don't make sense. Up is down, in is out. This is astounding. Right?
And this is where I think if Washington magically appeared today, he would not be surprised by the divide, by the partisanship. But what would deeply disturb him are the efforts to undermine the people's faith in government and the faith in a government of laws. As soon as that is undermined, the whole kit and caboodle is thrown out. That's what he was spending those 2 years of travel during the beginning of his presidency to do, was to establish the legitimacy of a government that transcended the ego of any one person, especially his ego. I mean, he used he had a charisma that no political leader since can really measure up to in terms of the broadness of that appeal. Washington could so easily have become the dictator, the democratic monarch or whatever.
They tried to give him that. They tried to, they tried to give him a title. They tried to give him, and he kept turning it down, right? He kept saying, no, I don't want that.
No. And from his point of view, the whole reason behind the revolution was to create a republic. I mean, this was the whole point. And even though everything seemed like it was falling apart in the years after the during the revolution and at the end, he insisted, no, if I do this, it will end the way all other revolutions have ended, with a coup, a military coup. And I am not going to do that. As King George would later say, if he walks away from ultimate power, he will be the greatest man in the world.
So he was the greatest man in the world because he did walk away. He said, no, I'm not going to run for re-election. It's time for another president to come in because we are not a monarchy. I'm not going to serve for the rest of my life. We need to get this to be an ongoing, you know, a president comes in and serves a term and somebody else is elected. So I guess, you know, he's still known today as the father of our country. Does he get the respect he deserves?
Well, you know, I wonder in this day and age. Yes, he was a slaveholder.
Yes.
He became an owner of enslaved people at the age of 11 when his father died and he inherited some slaves. And then, but by the time he died, he became the only slaveholding founding father to free his enslaved people. He changed. The American Revolution changed him. Even though he was from Virginia, grew to the point that he saw that slavery was going to be the would undermine what he had worked so hard for, the Union. Jefferson wrote down a statement of Washington's during his presidency where he said, if slavery should ever divide this country, I will go with the northern part. That's a pretty extraordinary statement from someone from Virginia. And so, yes, you know, Washington did hold people in bondage, but he did something pretty extraordinary. He began to question the preconceptions with which he grew up. And what he focused on was the Union. That is his great gift. It's the gift that moved Abraham Lincoln to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. You know, all of us are prisoners to our own time. Mm-hmm. When we look at the past, it's easy to judge. We can be self-righteous in our own time, but believe me, in 50 years, they're going to look back on what we're doing and say, what the heck were they thinking?
I would love to be able to come back in about 50 years and just read what's written about the former guy to see how history, you know, remembers him, because this was just a horrific 4 years, I believe, for life of people living here. But that's not what we're here to talk about today.
And in Washington's farewell address, he envisioned a possibility whereby a president would, instead of trying to unite the people, would try to divide them. Uh-huh. And he predicts with eerie prescience, what he says, you know, if you do this, people will not speak rationally. It will give opportunities for foreign powers to insert their influence. I mean, what he describes is what we've been through for the last four years.
And I got to ask, because I believe the first vaccine mandate came from George Washington, did it not?
It did. We would not have won the American Revolution if George Washington had not made the decision to vaccinate his troops.
Interesting.
And of smallpox.
Right.
And he had almost died of smallpox as a teenager. And this was, you know, this was something he decided to do. And so he was not an anti-vaxxer. this was not a question of personal liberty. This was survival. You know, it's the people's health. And as leader of an army, he determined that it was, you know, absolutely to everyone's benefit and to the cause to become vaccinated. And so there is a great old history of the U.S. and vaccinations. And if you're going to be a foundationalist and say, hey, you know, let's do it the way they did back then, I think you'd have to look at Washington's example and get yourself a couple of shots.
Please. Nathaniel Philbrick is with us, and the book is Travels with George. So you jump in your van with your wife and the dog. Obviously, the roads, everything is different than it was 200 and however many years before that George Washington made the same trek. But you did try to go to the same places he went to. I want to ask about, in the South, you brought up slavery, but in the South, there are a lot of those old slave plantations that are now, what are they, restored, and they give tours. And I guess some of them operate in a way to show the evils of slavery, but some kind of celebrate it. What did you find down there?
Well, what we found was, you know, this book and is also about public history, about how interpretations of history are changing. And a lot of them, you know, we did our tour before the great protests for social justice. That was happening as I was writing the book, which gave that process a real urgency. But what we discovered is that there are reinterpretations happening. When you go to, for example, Hampton Plantation in South Carolina, where Washington visited, it was there that he famously, the owner of the plantation wanted to cut down this live oak that was right in front of their new porch. And he said, no, you know, the guy who had supposedly cut down the cherry tree said, right. No, you know, a tree that beautiful cannot be replaced by man. It's still there. It's a living monument to, you know, his preservationist instincts. But there, if you go inside also, they list the African-American enslaved people who were on the docket there. And so that, you know, and their cost, and with very moving testimony to the sufferings they had, not only while enslaved, but their ancestors, the people after them would have under, you know, what was essentially a sharecropping situation. And so I would say it's changing. You know, yes, these buildings are massive. They were created through slavery was how they were funded and all that. But it's happening in the South. And it's not unanimous by any means. But it's one of the things we found was, yes, we're a divided country, but what was remarkable for us is when you're looking at the past locally and looking towards Washington, people show a real pride in their country, no matter what side of the fence they are. And it gave me hope that, hey, maybe we can work our way through this, find a time in the future where we can get back to what's important rather than fighting over stupid things like, should I get a vaccination or not?
Or should I pull down a statue of Robert E. Lee? So this is the times we're living in now where people are going, you know what? First of all of those Civil War memorials were really erected long after the Civil War. These were kind of screw yous to the African Americans who were getting equal rights. This was a Jim Crow thing to say, you know, we're white and we're superior or something. So now, right? So now Americans are going, hold on, that it may be a part of our history, but it's certainly not a part we want to honor. And so there's a big movement that thankfully is successful to pull down these memorials to Civil War quote heroes.
We went to Monument Avenue, and all of the statues were up. There was a study had been done, and there was plans to take down Jefferson Davis, but of course that became moot when the crowd took it into their own hands. And you know, and I respond to people who say, well, when a statue comes down, we are losing our history. No, we're not. Remember when the Declaration of Independence was first read in New York City, the people's response was to charge into the Bowling Green, where there was a huge statue of George III on a horse. They pulled it down. They then melted down the lead into bullets that were then used to fight the king and his army.
Wow.
You know, when statues like that come down, we aren't losing history. We're making history. This history doesn't sit frozen on a pedestal like a statue. History is ongoing, dynamic, as each generation redefines what this country was founded on, that all people are created equal.
Yes, but what I'm getting at is, I mean, you said, yeah, history isn't being lost when a statue is toppled to the ground. History is being made. And that's true because everything we do is part of history. So the mere act of saying we reject this part of our society who many years after the Civil War decided they were going to, flex their white supremacy muscles by putting up these horrific statues. Well, now we're taking that back. There is a place for these things in museums where you can learn about history and put it in that perspective. But there's a portion of our society right now that is fighting it, saying we need to honor these people. And that's the problem. We have people going around with Confederate flags, empowered by the former president who says, you know, after Charlottesville, there's very fine people on both sides because, go figure, they supported him. This is really dangerous. In Texas, They are so rewriting the history books. They're taking out mention. They're referring to slavery as an immigration program. Some of these books. This is really dangerous, isn't it?
It is dangerous because what you're doing is muzzling the process of history. The process of history is looking at the past through the lens of the present. Inevitably, you do that, you know, and to say, wait a minute, you cannot say anything bad about the past is to create something that never existed. It's to do a disservice to what heroes we may have, because you're not a hero if you're flawless and you just follow through with your perfectness. You're a hero if you somehow surmount the flaws we all have and do something actually that's good for the country and the world. And so to completely whitewash the past, to refuse to see any other portrayals of people other than sainthood is real disservice, especially to our children. And that's what's so troubling to me is that, you know, the Talons are getting into the curriculums, handcuffing the teachers, preventing them from teaching the history that, is acknowledged to be what actually happened, and coming up with a myth that really teaches nothing except for a wish fulfillment that in many cases fulfills our worst instincts.
Without a doubt. And the thing is with history, the further removed you are from it, you know, the more, especially now, our different stories come out. So here you go, Nathaniel, traveling in George Washington's footsteps to sort of get that perspective on his life and his presidency. What new things can you learn 200 and some odd years later, and know that what you're learning is accurate and hasn't been perverted by these people who just want to impose their own beliefs onto what was actually historical fact?
Yeah, well, that's where you've got to go to the original documents, the archives. You have, you can't rely on, someone's ghost-written account of what happened that reflects the ideology of their talk show. I mean, you've got to go into the archives, come up with the documents that were there. You know, and when it comes to Washington, it's such a rich archive of documents where he went to Newport, Rhode Island, which also happened to be the capital of the slave trade in America, which many Americans may not be aware of. Slavery is not by any means
South.
Only a Southern issue.
Right.
But there in Newport, there was a Jewish congregation, and one of the members asked the president in an address, said, are we guaranteed our freedoms under this new constitution? And his response has been called the most articulate defense of religious freedom ever written. And it's there. It's the words are there. They're on a page that was, written by him and his minions. And those are the words we should be looking at, not someone's, this is my version of what I would like him to have believed.
Right, right. Well, again, the way they're trying to rewrite history now, every American should be mortified. You know, when on January 6th, aside from chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," they were chanting 1776. And they were doing this in response to the 1619 Project that was published by the New York Times, where they vilified, what's her name, Hannah Nicole Jones, I think is her name, who put that together, for telling the story of how slaves were brought here and what was done to them. And this offends the Southern white supremacists that they are trying to create a whole new history. This is their 1776 project to invade the Capitol. It's astounding what and how we came so close to this coup going through. What we're learning. I hope the history books report on the last few years accurately. But I guess it all depends on who writes it. And I think someone recently said, I want to say it was like Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell or something, history is written by the victors. by the people who win the elections. All the more reason why the good guys, the people who believe in science and believe in actually telling the stories that were actual history, are win.
Yeah, no, it can be very distressing to see exactly that, you know, something as awful as an attack on the Capitol. Yeah, unbelievable. Something you could not even conceive. You couldn't believe it as it happened. Now being deterred, you know, these are heroes. And, you know, a bunch of knuckleheads egged on to desecrate, you know, the most important political structure building we have in this country. And it's just, you can look at it any way you want. It shows how everything is being politicized, and there's really no shame on either side when it comes to pushing for your issue. But, you know, the great leveler is the facts. And, you know, as soon as you lose track of that, as soon as it becomes an ideological seesaw back and forth, it's really distressing. One of the things Washington watched as the members of his own cabinet, Hamilton and Jefferson, went at each other tooth and nail, and they were on polar opposites of the ideological spectrum, and he pleaded with them. He said, you know, if you're finding yourself that far out, why, and there's someone else even farther to the other side, perhaps there's a middle course that might be the best thing for this nation. And, you know, that's, I think you've got, it's exactly where we are now, where we, you know, either side is going to push themselves into corners that not many people can relate to. We've got to begin to try to find a middle ground that is, can serve this country rather than polarizing.
Well, that, you know, from your words to the universe's action center or something, I don't know that that's possible. Look, I'm pretty progressive, but I don't consider myself radical. I think my thoughts, and I'm, you know, in line with Bernie Sanders and frankly what Joe Biden is trying to accomplish right now, which is not this crazy idea. But because the right has gone so far to the right, we seem further to the left by comparison, I guess. I don't know. It's just there is no center. And you have the media referring to these obstructionists in Congress as moderates and centrists. They're not the moderates, and there are no centrists. But you say, going back to the beginning, that you know, the country was as divided politically back then as we are now, and we were able to transcend that and come out as a nation. So you think it's possible? You're optimistic?
I think it's possible. I think these are forces that burn themselves out. I think it's very hard to actually do something to conciliate the two sides. These are forces that are so big and that they have to work themselves through. And this is, you know, this is the terrifying thing about history. What it teaches you is that whenever you're in the middle of it, you're too, you know, they're befogged by the uncertainty of the moment, that you've got to wait until, you know, things are happening that no one can control that will ultimately determine where you end up. And, you know, my hope is that, you know, you're seeing these kind of seismic shifts perhaps beginning to happen, but it's going to take time. And, you know, given the structure of this country, given that we are a union of, you know, we have a government of laws, I'm hopeful.
And a reasonable man in office right now. I'll put that out there.
A reasonable man in office. And, you know, and things like epidemics where, you know, when you do one crazy thing and it gets really bad, and your children potentially are involved, hopefully people just begin to see, well, you know, maybe there is a factual world, that a reality.
I hope so. Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you so much. The book is called Travels with George in Search of Washington and His Legacy. It's brand new this week. It's out. Get it. It's fascinating and an interesting take on those who came before us and hopefully those who will come after us. Thank you so much. It's nice meeting you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Great to meet you.
You take care. Bye-bye. All right. And with that, we are done. That's it for today and for the week. Oh, yes, it is. The weekend is here. Yay. So I'll leave you with the news. We'll be back Monday. On Monday, I believe we will have Nikki Freed, who's running for governor of Florida. She's supposed to join us at the top of the hour. My old friend Jim Defeaty should be here Monday as well. We'll see how it all shakes out. I got some work to do over the weekend. But yeah, so we got that going for us. And what else? I suppose that's it. I'll leave you with the news. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend. Mwah! Do something fun and stay safe. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Washington, D.C. is on alert and on edge as the weekend arrives. The black fence that surrounded the Capitol after the attack on January 6th is back up, temporarily, we're assured. Determined not to be caught unprepared again, Capitol Police and other law enforcement have ramped up security to avoid a repeat of what happened on January 6th. Most don't expect this rally, billed as a show of support for the insurrectionist still in jail awaiting trial, to be very big. The usual suspects from Marjorie Taylor Greene to Matt Gaetz are staying away, and organizers are cautioning participants not to wear pro-Trump gear and to act peacefully. Good luck with that. The former guy just couldn't stop himself from trying to whip his followers into a frenzy, this time issuing a statement that reads, quote, "Our hearts and minds are with the people being persecuted so unfairly relating to the January 6th protest concerning the rigged presidential election." Wow, he's delusional. He continued, quote, "In addition to everything else, it is proven conclusively that we are a two-tiered system of justice. In the end, however, justice will prevail." Okay, I certainly hope so. And then Trumper claimed that the Saturday event is a setup. He really is deranged. Well, the first sign of what could be the end of the country over party caucus of the GOP, Congressman Anthony Gonzalez of Ohio, one of just 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach Trump, announced that he will not seek re-election. He said it would have been a brutal primary fight against a former Trump aide. Citing in part threats of violence against his family, Gonzalez said that, quote, he could not bear the prospect of winning if it meant returning to a Trump-dominated House Republican caucus, and then he called Trump a, quote, cancer for the country. Gonzalez, who turns 37 on Saturday, is a Cuban-American former Ohio State wide receiver and first-round NFL draft pick. He went on to earn an MBA from Stanford. And that's who Republicans drive out of their party. Opposite world indeed. Remember when the former guy ordered an investigation into the origins of the Russia investigation?
I hope they now go and take a look at the origins of that investigation. About the Mueller report. The Mueller report, I wish, covered the origins, how it started, the beginnings of the investigation. How it started.
And then Attorney General Bill Barr appointed John Durham as special counsel to investigate the origins. Well, it's finally over. And on Thursday, John Durham indicted lawyer Michael Sussman. He represented the DNC and the Clinton campaign in connection with Russia's hack of their computer system. He's accused of falsely telling the former FBI general counsel James Baker in September of 2016 that he wasn't representing any client when he gave the FBI evidence of cyber connections between the Trump organization and a Russian bank. The Washington Post said legal experts promptly cast doubt on the case's broader significance, saying the alleged transgression seemed relatively minor given the length of time Durham's team has been at work. Randall Eliason, a former federal prosecutor who specialized in corruption cases, said if this is all Durham's got, it has a feel of trying to justify his existence for the last 2 years. But Trump said it was going to be huge. Now, if you want to talk about worthwhile investigations, the House Oversight and Reform Committee is launching one into fossil fuel industry disinformation on the climate crisis. Recent reports have suggested that the fossil fuel industry has participated in campaigns aimed at creating confusion
about the cause of the climate crisis or actively sown distrust in science. Lawmakers plan to invite the heads of six oil companies and major lobbying groups to testify next month. The hearing will align with Congress's planned timetable to pass huge climate and clean energy investments as part of Biden's budget bill, as well as the UN climate conference in Glasgow. So some fallout on a pact that President Biden announced on Thursday that'll help Australia deploy nuclear-powered submarines, and it's coming from the French. When he announced the agreement with Australia and the UK, President Biden said that it would reinforce U.S. alliances, a goal as the U.S. seeks to counter China's influence in the Pacific. But the foreign minister of France, Jean-Yves Le Drian, said the pact would prompt Australia to withdraw from a $66 billion deal they struck in 2016 to buy submarines from France. He called it a unilateral, brutal, unpredictable decision, similar to unpredictable and destabilizing policy changes made by the former guy. Stay tuned. In COVID news, Idaho public health leaders announced Thursday that they'd be expanding healthcare rationing statewide because a huge increase in coronavirus patients has overwhelmed their hospital system. The policy previously applied only to the northern parts of the state, but the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare now says hospitals should observe, quote, crisis standards of care, allotting ICU beds and other limited resources first to the patients most likely to survive. Similar policies have already been enacted in hospital systems in Alaska and Montana. I guess these are the death panels that Sarah Palin was warning us about. And we can't talk about COVID without mentioning Florida. The pandemic death toll here in the Sunshine State passed 50,000 on Thursday, capping off a summer surge of new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. This past week alone, Florida reached the second highest point since the pandemic began, reporting 1,554 new deaths and 9,760 new cases. So totals in Florida so far, 3,473,873 cases and 50,801 deaths. But we're warned that that number is likely an undercount. And finally, who are Mayim Bialik and Ken Jennings? It was announced on Thursday that they will share hosting duties for the remainder of 2021. While the search for a permanent host and executive producer continues, all right, their first episodes air Monday. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.